Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of violence, war, rape, murder, sexual assault, and torture.
Peter would not yet risk a general engagement, but slowly retired before the invaders, burning and destroying everything in his path, till, at last, the Swedes had nothing but a charred wilderness beneath their feet and a horizon of blazing villages before their eyes. While sometimes the air was so full of smoke that they could not see the sun. Nevertheless, the indomitable young king continued the pursuit, occupying every evening the camp the Russians had quitted the same morning, and striving in vain to overtake his elusive foe. Arnisbet Bane, Charles XII, and the collapse of the Swedish Empire. Peter I had just returned to Moscow after laying the foundation for St. Petersburg. He was staying at the residence of Alexander Menshikov when one of his female serfs caught the Tsar's eye. Her name was Martha Skavronskaya. She is remembered by her Orthodox name, Catherine I. She was previously married to a Swedish cavalry officer in her native Marienburg. When the city surrendered to Russian forces, the two lost contact forever, and it is likely that her Swedish husband died at some point during the Great Northern War. Martha began doing laundry for the occupying Russian army when Michael W. Simmons says, quote, she entered Menshikov's service, unquote. Menshikov was notorious for keeping female servants as housekeepers so that he could also sexually abuse them. But once Peter took a liking to Martha, Menshikov, quote, ceded his claim, unquote, to her, in favor of the Tsar. Peter loved the soon-to-be Catherine for a number of reasons. He felt she was incredibly beautiful, but beyond this, she was his intellectual equal. Additionally, she was able to nurse Peter back to health when he had his infamous stress-induced episodes, in which part of his face was paralyzed. Within a year, the couple would welcome their first child. They went on to have 12 children, although only two daughters would survive to adulthood. Peter and Catherine married in a private ceremony in 1708, but they would renew their vows at a public event held in 1712. Martha was now the Empress of Russia, Catherine I. And following the death of Peter, she would become the sole reigning sovereign and usher in an era of Russian dominance on the world stage. Voltaire writes, quote, there had been many instances before this of private women being raised to the throne. Nothing was more common in Russia and in all Asiatic kingdoms than for crowned heads to marry their own subjects. But that a poor stranger who had been taken prisoner in the storming of a town should become the absolute sovereign of that vast empire, whither she was led captive, is an instance fortune never produced, nor since, in the annals of the world. Unquote. Meanwhile, Charles was at the head of his 40,000-man army, supported by over 70 artillery pieces. Having just crossed the Vistula River, he made a mad dash through Poland and arrived at Grodno, the site of his 1706 campaign. Charles had continuously frustrated Russian delaying tactics. He skillfully went around Russian river positions on numerous occasions, showcasing his masterful ability to misdirect. At Grodno, the Swedes surprised the contingent of Russians and nearly managed to capture Tsar Peter, but he escaped alongside Menshikov's forces. At this point, Charles set up camp for the rest of winter and built up his strength for the summer campaign into Russia. He could go one of several ways. He could head north and assist his Livonian forces in liberating Swedish territory there. He could cut straight through Russia, bound directly for Moscow. Or he could veer south into Ukraine, where he could expect support from native Cossacks under Ivan Mazepa. Charles decided to go straight for Moscow, in the hopes of ending the war quickly, although the majority of his lieutenants wanted to go north and liberate the Baltic states before moving on to St. Petersburg. This move by the Swedes was unexpected. Peter, who was at the head of a 70,000-man army, rushed to burn or take away anything of value along the Swedish line of march. In the meantime, Menshikov had to delay the Swedish army for as long as possible. He would do this by fortifying the many river crossings throughout eastern Poland and modern-day Belarus. From Finland to Livonia, into the heart of the Russian Empire, over 70,000 Swedes waged war against 110,000 Russians. In Finland, Swedish armies were attempting to retake St. Petersburg. In Livonia, they were trying to win back lost ground, but the main Swedish effort was clearly with Charles, who was currently attempting to cross the Berezina River. The Russians tried once more to halt the Swedish advance, but once again, Charles outmaneuvered his enemies, forcing the Russians into retreating. They retreated to the Vabek River and spread their forces out to all possible crossings, ensuring that a battle would have to be waged in order for the Swedes to cross. The Russians were dispersed across the length of the river. This left each Russian grouping isolated. Charles recognized this immediately, and he devised a masterful plan for defeating them. On the night of July 3rd, 1708, his artillery crept into place, and come the morning, the action began with a massive barrage, targeted at Russian positions. This barrage was the most effective Swedish artillery action throughout the entire war. It disoriented the Russians and made it possible for the Swedes to cross the deep river, albeit with their muskets held over their heads. Charles led the way, and once his men were set up, they began an impetuous advance against the Russian center. The Russian commander recognized his faulty positioning, and he began a fighting retreat. Charles emphatically pushed his men forward. Meanwhile, Russian cavalry was attempting to turn the Swedish flank, but they were intercepted by Reinskjöld, who was at the head of the Swedish cavalry. They forced the Russians back, who retreated through their own infantry, further sabotaging Russian cohesion. The Russians were ultimately pushed off the heights and then forced to retreat. Upwards of 1,200 Swedes were killed or wounded, while as many as 5,000 Russians suffered a similar fate. The Battle of Hollovinsen showcased several things for all parties involved. Sweden began to grow ever more fearful of Russian military capabilities. They had become more strategic and less willing to throw their armies away. The battle also demonstrated that Swedish tactics could be counteracted, but Swedish aggressiveness could still win out. Charles, regardless of all this, was at the zenith of his powers. He had coupled a surprise artillery barrage alongside an impetuous infantry advance at an isolated section of the Russian army. He also recognized the poor Russian position and was able to exploit it. What is remembered as the Battle of Hollovinsen was his favorite victory. The route to the Dnieper River was now open. Charles's army reached the Great River on July 9th, 1708. It was here they rested and waited for supplies which were supposed to be brought to them by General Hohenhaupt in Livonia, alongside 11,000 reinforcements. Lohenhaupt had to escort 2,000 wagons, tens of thousands of pack animals, and thousands of camp followers through hostile territory, and then meet with Charles at the Dnieper. There were a dozen problems, both in acquiring the supplies and in transporting them. Charles was growing ever impatient at having to wait for these supplies while the entire countryside was devastated and burned around him due to Russian scorched-earth tactics. There was no more food for the horses, and the men were already suffering from the summer heat, as several diseases were spreading throughout the Swedish camp. Charles could have turned around and met up with Leeuwenhoek and his men, but he refused to engage in any movement that even resembled a retreat. At this moment, Charles made an impulsive mistake. He decided to veer south into Severia and Ukraine, where he hoped to gain better forage and supplies. Turning south into Severia, Charles dispatched an elite forward strike force of several thousand men headed by Anders Lagercrona. He was ordered to occupy the important towns and villages of Severia and northern Ukraine. Additionally, Lagercrona was supposed to link up with Ivan Mazepa and his Cossacks. As the Swedish army veered south, Leeuwenhoek and his supply train were less than 200 miles away. 3 days was all that separated the supplies from the main Swedish army. If Charles had only waited, he would have been reinforced and supplied enough to be able to march on Moscow directly. As it stood, Leeuwenhoek's supplies were now isolated deep in enemy territory, and the Russians had caught wise to this fact. They planned an ambush centered on the Swedish supply train. By September 23, 1708, Leeuwenhoek realized that he would have to fight his way out. Over 14,000 Russians bore down on the Swedish host, which was heavily encumbered by the wagons and animals they were herding. For several days, Russians harassed the Swedish until they cornered them around the town of Lesnaya. Leeuwenhoek used his supply wagons as impromptu defenses instead of sending them forward. This is considered another severe error, although it was one which was seemingly unavoidable. All throughout the day on September 28th, Swedish forces desperately resisted numerous Russian attacks. As night descended, Leeuwenhoek decided to destroy his cumbersome cannon and burn the supplies for which he was responsible. Swedish forces then began raiding their own supply wagons and deserting in groups to the nearby forest. In total, almost half of the Swedish army was destroyed, alongside all of their supplies and pack animals. 6,000 starving and disheveled men were all that made it to the main Swedish army. Swedish propaganda spun the defeat into a glorious resistance. They claimed over 50,000 Russians assaulted the Swedes, but this number was nowhere near accurate. In reality, the Russians had adapted their tactics to confront the Swedes, and their hard work was paying off. No longer were Russian armies unwieldy forces of peasants. Now they were highly professional and regulated. Peter understood that he had just scored a massive victory, one that set the stage for a much more climactic engagement. For this reason, he called the Battle of Lesnaya, quote, the mother of Poltava, unquote. As Swedish armies were met with defeat in Belarus, Swedish forces were trying to win back lost ground in Ingria. An army of 14,000 invaded the Karelian Peninsula in early 1708, with the intention of recapturing St. Petersburg. This force was fooled by an effective Russian disinformation campaign, which stated that St. Petersburg was heavily defended. In reality, the city had a scant garrison and would have easily capitulated to a determined Swedish push. As a result of this failure in intelligence gathering, Swedish forces campaigned aimlessly through Karelia, and by the close of operations, Swedish forces had lost 3,000 men and 6,000 horses. In Ukraine, Lagercrona's strike force was failing spectacularly at seizing their supposed objectives. Not only did they fail to secure major river crossings and bridges, but they also failed to capture the regional capital of Stardub. This capture would have solved the supply crisis plaguing the army, but as it stood, Swedish soldiers would continue to suffer intense malnourishment, and many had no shoes. To make the supply situation worse for the Swedes, the hobbled survivors of Lohenhoff's army arrived in equally poor condition and equally hungry. Upon learning of Lagercrona's failure, Charles exclaimed, quote, "He must be mad," unquote. Charles now had to make do with what he had on hand. He was by no means defeated yet. Turning south offered several advantages to the Swedes. First of all, supply and forage was conceivably more attainable in Ukraine since it was not intentionally devastated by Russian forces. Additionally, Ukraine was home to the Cossacks, a hardy group of nomadic warriors who had hitherto maintained nominal loyalty to Russia, but were now seeking to forge an autonomous state in Ukraine under their leader, Ivan Mazepa. Mazepa is one of the more interesting figures in history and is considered a founding father of the modern-day country of Ukraine. He began life poor, but his natural charisma and abilities led to his quick advancement. It also helped that Mazepa was a notorious womanizer who seduced numerous wealthy Polish women. On one such romantic endeavor, the woman's husband arrived home early, and he strapped the young Ukrainian man to a stallion and then set the stallion loose on the steppe. Mazepa would have died were it not for the Cossacks who saved his life. His fortune improved once more, and his natural leadership abilities were obvious to his comrades, who named him their hetman, or commander, by popular vote. In previous years, the Cossacks maintained nominal loyalty towards the Tsar, but they always cherished their right to self-rule. To give some idea of how much the Cossacks cherished their personal freedom and autonomy, I will quote at length a letter written to the Ottoman Sultan from Ivan Serko, the hetman of Korchevoj. For reference, the Sultan had written to the Cossacks and demanded that they swear fealty to the Ottoman Empire. This is the Cossacks' response. Quote, "Thou Turkish Satan, thou damned brother of the devil and secretary of Lucifer himself. What manner of beast art thou? The evil one vomits what thou swallowest. Thou art not worthy of having Christian sons beneath thee. We fear not thy army, and on land, as well as also on the sea, would we fight thee, thou Babylonian cook, Macedonian stave-binder, brewer of Jerusalem, Alexandrian goat-thief, swine-herd from Big and Little Egypt, Tartar ram, Carmaniac butcher-boy, evil-doer from Pedolia, seed of the very devil, the clown of the upper as well as the lower world, swine-snout and horse's tail, red-haired bitch, unbaptized skull, may the evil one catch thee. Thus the Cossacks answer thee, thou heathen, thou art unworthy of the mother of true Christians. The date we know not, for we have not calendar. The moon is in the sky. The year is in the book. And outside of this, it is the same day here as with thee." Unquote. The Cossacks had bristled under Russian overlordship for years, but the military reforms of Peter were the final nail in the coffin for men like Mazepa, who cherished their traditional way of life. Peter passed an increase in taxes and was also demanding all Cossack forts be handed over to the Russian military. As a result, Mazepa sent out feelers for an alliance with the King of Poland, Stanislaus. He promised him and the invading Swedish army over 30,000 Cossack cavalrymen. Peter had ascertained his vassal's intentions and decided to stomp out any whiff of rebellion in his empire. He ordered an army to march on the Cossack capital of Baturin, and they utterly devastated it. Besides destroying the capital, Russian soldiers massacred and raped civilians in the thousands. The Cossacks then split amongst pro-Russian and anti-Russian forces. Mazeppa needed to retreat in a hurry, bringing only 2,000 or so hungry Cossacks to the Swedish camp. A few thousand more Cossacks loyal to Mazeppa would arrive in the Swedish camp in the coming months, but they had little impact in the fight to come. Regardless, Mazeppa's leadership and renown in the area was a boon for Swedish morale, if only temporarily. The Swedes had to content themselves with foraging for supplies as winter set in. Unfortunately for them, the winter of 1708 and 1709 was one of the coldest ever recorded in European history. Remembered as the Great Frost, nearly all of Europe was engulfed in freezing temperatures unseen since the Ice Age. Venetian lagoons froze over. French fruit trees died in their thousands. In Sweden, elk were found frozen standing up. In Ukraine, the effects were just as terrible. Birds froze in midair and fell to the ground as if they had been shot by a bullet. The little forage, which had previously been available, disappeared rapidly. The effects these conditions had on the two armies were severe. Men died in the thousands from exposure. Carl Gustafsson Klingspor lost two fingers from frostbite, and he said it was not uncommon for noses and ears to fall off of a man's body as he marched. He further claimed men would die in the saddle and only be discovered dead hours later, their bodies frozen to the horse's saddle. To compound issues, Tsar Peter was determined to give the Swedes to his front no rest. He forced Charles into a game of maneuvers in the sub-zero weather, further exposing the Swedes to its effects. Charles came close to engaging with the Russians on several occasions, but each time, Russian units would fall back in the face of a determined Swedish push. Henrik Olund describes this winter campaign thus, quote, "The Russians undertook what could be called hit-and-run tactics. They would appear to threaten a place, but withdraw as soon as the Swedes approached. The Swedes captured some towns taken over by the Russians and drove the Tsar out of his headquarters in Lebeden." Unquote. The two armies would come into close contact once more around Hadjak, but once again the Russians would retreat, leaving the Swedes to suffer. Those unable to find shelter froze in the night. When dawn arose, 2,000 Swedes had died. Charles could comprehend men dying in combat for the Swedish motherland, but the fact that so many young people were dying of the cold and diseases gnawed at Charles more and more. He mused that he wanted to face Peter in personal combat to bring an end to the war, while also complaining about incessant nightmares and lack of sleep. The cold became so unbearable that, for the first time in living memory, Swedish Christmas service had to be canceled. This was viewed as an ill omen for the Swedes who remained. In early January, after the worst of the cold had passed, Charles went on the offensive. His army was a shell of its former self. A brutalized rabble of just over 20,000 men remained. Of these, less than half were combat effective. The rest suffered from severe frostbite and disease. Their first obstacle was the fort of Virpik. The Russian garrison was ready for the Swedes. Gustav Adlerfeld relates, quote, "The enemy had thrown a quantity of water on the ramparts, which was frozen on all sides, and the garrison, taking advantage of the difficulty which our men met, defended themselves in a most desperate manner. We lost many brave men." Unquote. In total, 1,000 Swedes were wounded or died in the fighting, which was supposed to be only a small blip in the larger campaign to come. These forces were irreplaceable at this point. Now, it's important to stress that the Russians were suffering just as severely, if not more so, from the intense winter conditions. It's estimated many more Russians died than Swedes, but in Peter's eyes, these forces were easily replaceable and easily disposable. Charles had had enough of being constantly harassed by the Russians whenever his army attempted to forage for food or march on a new objective. he began what is described by Henrico Lund as a, quote, merciless winter campaign, unquote. He took a note from the Russian playbook and began pillaging the countryside and laying waste to anything of value the Russians could attain. During one such lightning raid, Charles, at the head of a body of cavalry, stormed Menshikov's headquarters, killing 400 Russians and nearly capturing the Russian commander. Swedish tactics were proving effective, and Peter had to retreat farther and farther in the face of the Swedish advance. Many Swedish soldiers were hungry and shoeless, but they fought with a continued ferocity. Lutheran doctrine holds that all people have a predetermined destiny or fate. This imbued many Swedish fighting men with an utter contempt for death. This attitude undoubtedly helped the Swedish Empire stay alive and continue its fight well after the point of breaking. Meanwhile, in Poland, a Russian army was devastating the countryside. The inadequate defenses which had been left to guard the Commonwealth were no match for the professional Russians opposing them. At this point, many Swedish officials, headed by the experienced statesman Karl Piper, voiced their view that the Swedish army should retreat back into Poland and assist their allies, as well as the Swedish forces which remained there. Charles, once again, refused to order anything which looked like a retreat. He said he would end the war on his terms from inside Moscow. To get to Moscow, the fortress city of Pultava would have to be taken. Once the roads were dry, Charles besieged the city with his meager army. Besides logistical issues, morale was declining all the time. Desertions, which were previously small in number, began to increase. Worse still, with the spring thaw, millions of mosquitoes and bugs emerged, spreading disease and irritation throughout the Swedish ranks. Around this time, an emissary from Peter arrived at the Swedish camp. Peter was proposing peace based on the original boundaries of the two nations, save for St. Petersburg and other parts of Ingria. Charles once again refused the peace deal. The city of Poltava was not only strategically crucial, but also logistically important to the Swedes. The city was well stocked with supplies and fresh powder for the muskets and cannon. During the winter, Swedish powder had become so wet that it was practically inoperable. Carl Gustafsson Klingspor says Swedish cannon sounded like, quote, a pair of wet gloves clapping, unquote, because of the poor quality of the powder. Charles searched fruitlessly for allies. He reached out to the Ottoman Sultan as well as the Khan of the Crimean Tatars. Both these polities wished Charles well on his campaign, but beyond this, they offered no aid. Additionally, the rebellion of the Zaporozhian Cossacks was brutally crushed the same month Sweden began their siege of Poltava. Upon learning of Swedish designs against Poltava, Peter decided to meet Charles in the open field for the first time. Peter had already tried and failed to cross the Vorskla River. He would try again, and the Swedes would try to score a decisive victory against them. The Swedish plan would allow for a portion of the Russian army to cross the Vorskla before falling on the army while it was still in transit. On June 17, 1709, disaster struck in the form of a bullet. During one of his routine inspections of the front around Poltava, Charles was wounded by a musket ball, which entered his left heel and exited out of his big toe. The pain must have been extraordinary, but Charles refused to be looked at by a doctor. For over 2 hours, he continued his inspections as if nothing had ever happened, blood pouring from his boot the whole time. Upon returning to his tent, Charles attempted to dismount from his horse, but he passed out from blood loss. When he was finally inspected by a doctor, many around the Swedish camp feared the worst, especially when an infection and fever began to ravage their king. For 3 days, Charles was at death's door before he finally recovered from his fever and his foot began to heal. The rotten parts of his foot had to be cut off, but Swedish doctors refused to inflict pain on the king. Charles grabbed the scissors himself and cut away the affected flesh on his foot as if it was the most natural thing in the world to do. This debilitating injury was sustained on Charles's birthday, and besides being considered an ill omen, the wound would continue to affect Charles and his ability to walk for the rest of his life. It was not the first time Charles had suffered a debilitating injury on the campaign trail. More than once during one of his famous horse rides, he got into severe accidents. On one occasion, he shattered his femur during the fall. As the king slowly recovered, a makeshift stretcher was fashioned for him. It was designed to be carried to the battlefield by a litter of 24 people. Reinskjold was left in overall command of Swedish forces. He had 10 cavalry and 8 infantry battalions available to him. This force was intended to interrupt the Russian crossing of the Vorskla around the town of Petrovka. But Reinskjold and the Swedish high command hesitated. They refused to launch the planned interception and instead allowed the entire Russian army to cross the river, set up a fortified camp, and construct forward defensive bastions. Henrik Olund considers this a total strategic failure on Sweden's part, saying it, quote, contributed to the disaster that followed, unquote. Both armies were poorly positioned for a retreat, and it was something the Swedes had hitherto proved incapable of executing. Due to this fact, a general battle was unavoidable. Charles would finally get the engagement he had been praying for, but it was not the engagement he wanted. The Russian camp was constructed in a massive quadrilateral and well-placed to receive a Swedish assault. Russian engineers did a masterful job constructing a forward defensive post consisting of 6 separate wooden redoubts, while another 4 were in the process of being constructed when the battle started. The Swedes were severely outnumbered. Henrik Olund says that their force consisted of, quote, 8,200 infantry, 7,800 cavalry, 1,000 irregular Wallachians, and 1,300 siege work troops with 2 guns, unquote. The rest of the Swedish army was spread out along the Vorskla River, besieging Poltava, and protecting the baggage train, which contained the rest of the Swedish artillery. The lack of artillery would be a huge hindrance for any Swedish attack, but they simply had no powder or cannon for their guns. Swedish soldiers scurried about the field searching for Russian cannonballs to use in their few pieces. Meanwhile, the Russians fielded an absolutely massive force of 25,000 infantry, over 120 guns, 9,000 cavalry, as well as a number of infantry, cavalry, and artillery dispersed amongst the several Russian redoubts. It was an overwhelming force compared to that which Charles fielded. This would have been bad enough for the Swedes, but they also suffered from a lack of coordination and no coherent command structure. Charles was present on the field, but he refused the mantle of overall commander, erring to support General Reinskjold, who in turn gave unclear instructions to his subordinate commanders. This led to an intense amount of confusion, as each assignment was loosely defined. The Swedes had hoped to catch the Russians unawares, but their attempts at concealment failed utterly. The men in column were ordered to change into line formation. This further frustrated the Swedish plan of attack. The Russians responded to the planned Swedish attack by moving a force of cavalry to defend the forward positions which they had constructed in the night. Apprehension was palpable on the Swedish side. Carl Gustafsson Klingspor says, quote, "We all felt as if some great disaster were about to happen," unquote. Before ordering the general advance against the Russians, Reinskjold turned to the king and said, quote, "I hope with God's help, Your Majesty, it will go well," unquote. The king responded from his litter, quote, "In God's name, then, let us march to the attack," unquote. The ill-clad Swedish army surged forward. They lacked food, ammunition, and cohesion, but they were still determined to show that they were the bravest army in Europe, and perhaps the world. At first, the impetuous charge succeeded and captured the first two Russian forward bastions relatively easily. But as the fight dragged on, Swedish units became bogged down, attempting to capture the well-defended Russian defenses. Swedish units on the left succeeded in capturing several Russian guns and turning them against their defenders. But on the right, an isolated Swedish unit became hopelessly lost and was surrounded by 10,000 Russians who would compel their surrender. R. Nisbet Bain relates what happens next, quote, "The issue of the battle was still doubtful. Lewenhaupt, with his infantry, was preparing to storm the southern side of the enemy's entrenched camp when he received an order to halt," unquote. Who exactly gave this order remains a mystery, but R. Nisbet Bain implies it was Charles. He claims Reinskjold lost his patience with the king, saying, quote, "Yes, sir, that is what you are always doing. I am never allowed to do what I would. For God's sake, sir, leave me to manage," unquote. This may have been the first time in his entire life when Charles showed doubt and indecision on the battlefield. In this crucial interim between the arranging of the Swedish attack and its actual execution, Russian forces sallied out of their entrenched camp and decided to meet the Swedish charge head-on. 4,000 Swedes charged across the barren field, which was already covered with corpses. For a moment, the Russians wavered, but Peter personally led reinforcements into the threatened area, shouting, quote, "Where is my brother Charles?" unquote. His shouting was so loud that Carl Gustafsson Klingspor claims he could hear him over the din of battle. Before the 4,000 Swedes even reached the Russian lines, 2,000 had fallen. R. Nisbet Bain says, quote, "The remainder of the gallant little band rushed forward and literally disappeared among the myriads of Russians who engulfed and overwhelmed them," unquote. The battle was essentially over, but the killing did not cease. Charles tried to stem his routing forces, shouting incessantly for his fleeing men to rally around him and his litter. Of the 24 litter-bearers Charles had begun the battle with, only 3 were still alive. Finally, a cannonball completely shattered his stretcher and left the king defenseless. Charles was moments from being made a prisoner, but a selfless Swedish officer dismounted his horse and threw the king upon it. This horse was shot from under Charles, and in the fall, his foot wound reopened and began bleeding profusely. Charles acquired another mount and somehow managed to escape alongside several aides and Cossack allies. In a single afternoon, the main Swedish army, which had remained undefeated in all engagements which mattered for nearly a decade, was utterly smashed. 7,000 Germans, Finns, Balts, and Swedes were dead on the field outside of Poltava, while another 3,000 were made prisoners. These Swedish prisoners of war were treated as trophies and paraded in chains through Moscow in an opulent ceremony. Few would ever see their homeland again, as many died from exposure and cruelty when they were forced to work in Russian labor camps. The remnants of the Swedish army, some 16,000 men, converged on Pushkarivka. Lewenhaupt was now in overall command, as Reinskjold had fallen into enemy hands. Reinskjold was presented to Tsar Peter, who toasted the Swedish field marshal as his teacher in war, and had the field marshal's sword returned to him. Russian forces, although exhausted, could not afford to waste this opportunity. General Menshikov, at the head of over 8,000 fast-moving men, caught up with the bedraggled Swedish army around Perevolchna. This was a crucial river crossing, and the Swedes made a point to allow their Cossack allies to cross the river into Ottoman territory first. The Swedes understood that all the Cossacks would have been slaughtered if they fell into Russian hands. Henrik Olund says, quote, To do otherwise would be a stain on Swedish honor, unquote. Charles was determined to stand by his army's side, regardless of the outcome. Despite his objections, he was taken at the head of 1,000 horsemen who crossed the river as well. Charles demanded that the army continue to fight, and Loenhaupt promised to follow the king's last order. Once the king was safely away from army headquarters, Loenhaupt began to backpedal on his promises to resist to the end. He saw the situation in front of him, and it was absolutely dire. Russian units were closing in on the Swedish host from all directions, and the few soldiers able to fight seemed absolutely demoralized. He called his subordinates together and asked their opinion. They dutifully asked what the king's orders were. Loenhaupt said his orders were to hold out as long as possible, not to resist until the end. The officers were still deeply divided, so Loenhaupt made the unprecedented move to poll the soldiers fighting under him. They all gave a half-hearted reply that, quote, they would fight if the others would, unquote. In reality, the Russians were in as precarious a state as the Swedes, and had Loenhaupt chosen to engage with Menshikov's meager forces, it would have likely met with success. As it was, Loenhaupt made the controversial but not unexpected decision to surrender the entire Swedish army of over 14,000 men to Menshikov. Of these tens of thousands, few would ever see their home again. 5,000 Cossacks remained with the Swedish army, and when the surrender was announced, they attempted to exit the camp with all haste. Some got away, but thousands of others were tortured and butchered in front of their Swedish allies, who could only look on in horror as the people they came to liberate met a gruesome fate. The Russian campaign exposed the main flaw in the Swedish military system, one which would plague future commanders as they attempted to negotiate the massive spaces in Russia. This flaw was the lack of adequate supply and means of transporting these supplies to the army. The original plan was to forage off the supposedly bountiful countryside. Peter proved his strategic genius, as well as his capriciousness, when he decided to destroy much of his own country in order to frustrate the enemy's designs. Meanwhile, Charles proved the failure of strictly using offensive tactics with little strategic planning. Boldness and even victory mattered for little in this vast step. Cunning and resourcefulness were much more important traits here, and Peter simply outwitted and outmatched Charles in every conceivable way. One of the biggest critics of Charles and his Russian campaign was Napoleon Bonaparte. He claimed Charles was never a true tactician or military leader. He claims Charles was just a, quote, good soldier, unquote. Napoleon claimed he would never make the same mistakes as Charles, and even had a copy of Voltaire's Charles XII by his bedside throughout his own Russian campaign. However, Napoleon ended up making the same crucial error as Charles. He had no contingencies in place for a broken supply system, and his Grand Armée was destroyed because of it. In early July of 1709, Charles crossed the Bug River into Ottoman-controlled Moldavia. Alongside the exiled king were hundreds of attendants and horsemen. They were granted passage into the state and given protections under the laws of Sharia. On the other side of the Bug River, 600 Swedes and Cossacks fought a desperate holding action against the Russians. The 300 Swedes surrendered, but the 300 Cossacks fought to the last man rather than face Russian torture. In spite of the military defeat that Sweden suffered, Charles remained in a seemingly good mood upon his arrival to the Ottoman domain. Following the battle, he wrote to his sister, quote, "Only at the end of the year, and only due to a special coincidence, did the army unfortunately suffer losses which I hope in short order to rectify," unquote. This was the understatement of the century, as the Swedish army ceased to exist in Ukraine. News also arrived from Sweden about the passing of Princess Hedwig Sophia. This was a deep blow to Charles, who wept for days on end upon hearing the news of the death of his sister. He loved his sister intensely, even referring to her as, quote, my heart, unquote. She was survived by a young child named Frederick. The two looked incredibly similar, so much so that Charles broke down into tears when he first viewed a portrait of his nephew. Now that he was in the Ottoman lands, Charles constructed a brick house for himself and his entourage. A bustling Swedish community, referred to as New Bender, began to grow around his residence. Charles acclimatized very well to Muslim culture and came to like the religion and its adherents. Charles wanted to leave Ottoman lands as quickly as possible, but things kept cropping up which forced him to stay. First, his foot had to heal. Next, he waited in vain for a new army to march through Poland to meet him. Michael Glaser says, quote, months ended up becoming years. Charles dove into Turkish politics and supported the more hawkish ministers in their efforts to have either the Tartar Khan or the Sultan declare war against Russia, unquote. His goals nearly succeeded when the Ottoman state declared war on Russia in 1710. A 200,000-man army marched into Ukraine from the Balkans. Peter advanced to meet it with 60,000 men, and for the first time since Narva, he overplayed his hand and found himself in a truly desperate situation. His 60,000 were practically besieged by the massive Ottoman army surrounding them. Charles urged the Ottomans on and hoped they would be able to wipe out the Russians opposing them and perhaps even capture Peter. It was not to be, however. The Ottoman state and Peter signed a hasty peace treaty which awarded Azov back to the Ottomans, along with vast amounts of money. This was not what Charles wanted, and the news from across Europe was becoming more dire. Augustus I of Saxony was back, and following the signing of the Treaty of Thorn, he was renamed the Polish king. Stanislaus had to abdicate his throne and vacate Poland in a hurry, and Denmark rejoined the conflict, seeing another opportunity to strike. Swedish gains made in the past decade were wiped away in a matter of months. We know very little about how these events affected Charles, since most of the Swedish documents relating to this period were destroyed in the coming skirmish against the Ottomans. Things were becoming increasingly precarious for the Swedish state, and the bureaucracy, which had hitherto operated efficiently, began to collapse in the face of repeated challenges and demands. In countless instances, Charles became incredibly agitated at the actions of the statesmen and generals who were attempting to keep the country afloat. Meanwhile, plans were being laid in Bender to remove the king from his comfortable abode and send him in shackles to Russia. One of the main conspirators in this plot was Augustus of Poland, who was able to influence the governor of Bender to support his plans. Augustus managed to convince the Ottoman governor that he was part of an anti-Russian alliance and that he wished for Charles to be, quote-unquote, captured so that he could converse with his cousin. The small Swedish garrison of Bender caught wind of this plan, and they refused Ottoman entreaties to leave their fortified camp. For weeks, Swedish forces held out against a much larger Ottoman force, led by the duplicitous governor, who neglected to inform the Sultan of his plans. Charles penned a list of demands and ended it by writing, quote, "We are prepared to stand against any who would want to attack us," unquote. With the Sultan now informed of the situation at New Bender, he attempted to remain as neutral as possible, but eventually his patience gave way to frustration. For years he had housed, fed, and clothed the Swedish king and his entourage, and when he was asked to provide a monetary loan to the king, he decided now was the time to remove Charles from his land and send him on a ship home. The Sultan seemed to be completely unaware of the conspiracy brewing between Augustus, Peter, and the governor of Bender. A force of several thousand men marched on the walls of New Bender, which had been reinforced by the small Swedish garrison there. The Ottoman side wished to prevent bloodshed. The same was true for the Swedes, wanted to prolong the battle for as long as possible in the hopes of further intervention by the Sultan. Ottoman forces bristled at the mouth of the fortified camp, and they waited for the signal to attack. When it finally came, they launched themselves with reckless abandon at Swedish positions, and Swedish officers ordered their men to lay down their arms and surrender rather than die pointlessly. The only Swedish resistance that day came from the royal residence, which was defended by Charles and his staff. Serious hand-to-hand fighting ensued, and a bullet grazed the face of Charles, while a sword strike hit his hand and glanced off his head. His only protection for this latter blow was a cap made of otter skin. During the fight, the royal residence caught fire, causing the skirmish to spill out into the streets. It was during the fighting here that Charles tripped on the spurs of his boots and was finally captured by Ottoman forces. Remembered as the Kalabalik, the skirmish resulted in the deaths of almost 50 Swedes and Turks. Additionally, Charles was wounded thrice. The final injury was sustained during the king's fall, when he broke several bones in his foot. Charles and 100 of his men were moved to Adrianople in the south, where the Swedes lived under virtual house arrest, and Charles was bedridden with his foot injury. The Peace of Utrecht was signed in 1713, ending the War of the Spanish Succession, but war still raged across northern and eastern Europe. Politics across the continent were vastly different as well. In Britain, George I of Hanover ascended to the throne. This made the Duchy of Hanover extremely powerful in central Germany. They looked at Swedish possessions in Germany with a lustful eye. Prussia also felt confident enough to challenge the Swedish in Pomerania. Charles still remained confident. He wrote, quote, "I believe our fortunes will improve in the coming year, since they have already been unsettled enough in the past few years," unquote. Charles schemed up a way to elude his Turkish captors, who were likely glad to be rid of the king. Late on October 27, 1713, he left Adrianople in disguise. By November 5th, he reached Vienna. He turned north toward the German principalities, bound for the few enclaves of Swedish territory left in Europe. The pace of the journey increased significantly. Over the next 5 days, Charles tore a path through Europe, arriving in Stralsund on the night of November 10th. Michael Glaser concludes, quote, "The journey took 14 days and covered 2,152 kilometers, which is 1,300 miles. Such was the daily pace, over 150 kilometers, or 93 miles, that the king needed a new uniform and new boots to replace those that had to be cut from his swollen feet," unquote. To put this in perspective for those listening, imagine if you traveled nonstop on horseback from New York City to Key West in Florida. Even then, you still would not have covered the entire distance Charles had. Tyr, the Nordic god of war, was finally out of exile, and the news of his return sent shivers down the spines of each allied leader. All across the massive front, from which Swedish forces were being pushed back, allied units called a dead halt and began to defend and reinforce. Charles proved he was worth an entire army to his people and his enemies alike. Celebrations hailing the king's return were held all across what remained of the Swedish Empire. Finally, there was a sliver of hope in a sea of ill tidings and bad news. A medal cast with the king's words, quote, "What worries you so? God and I still live," unquote, was forged upon Charles' arrival in his homeland. The final climactic chapter of the Great Northern War is one of hope, betrayal, failure, conspiracy, and death. Tune in to the next episode of Turning Tides to hear the rest. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening.
If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen. and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, M-O-V-O-P-H-O-T-O. Thank you again.